It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 384 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, it's a special interview with Ron Randall, the creator of Trekker, who has a Kickstarter going on right now for Trekker Battlefields. And as he has during every Kickstarter he's done, you go to TrekkerKickstarter.com for the latest. It's doing well, but it needs your support because we want to see Trekker go for a long, long time. Ron and I talk about how the book came to be, about the characters and what we might expect from them in the future, as well as what he has planned for future campaigns should they take place. We talk about the industry some, as well as conventions and what they mean to Kickstarter campaigns from his perspective. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's a great pleasure to talk with Ron Randall, the creator behind Trekker, a long-lived and wonderful series of sci-fi adventures that I really enjoy. How are you doing, Ron?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you. Of course, you've got a Kickstarter going, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I met you for the first time at AwesomeCon this year, and I was so glad to see that. I picked up three of your books there. Actually, I picked up two. I picked up the other one through one of your most recent Kickstarter. So I got you to sign them all, and I was glad to see the other two. I hadn't gotten them. What does convention attending do for you? I mean, as far as getting the word out and stuff like that, does it help with your Kickstarters?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm not really sophisticated enough to have a real way to track, because I talked to this person at a convention, I know for sure that they went to the Kickstarter. But conventions do a lot of things for me. The primary thing it does, I think, is it helps to inspire me and energize me, because Trekker is in that category of passion projects that several of us creators like to go on and on about. Trekker is that for me. It's the one series that I was able to build from the ground up. It's completely mine. And so when I go to a convention and I come across somebody who's just discovered it and they come up and they're enthusiastic about it and embracing the characters and the world, frankly, it's just quite an adrenaline rush. And since we cartoonists tend to work in isolation a lot, and we're doing work that we hopefully are pleased with ourselves and enthralled by, but you can sometimes not have a firm grasp on whether or not to really make a connection with other people. And I'm a storyteller. I want to tell stories to other people and have them get it, have it resonate and that stuff. And the conventions is the most immediate, the most inspiring and energizing way I have to have that experience. So I love conventions for that reason. And I also do use them to, hand out. Like when I'm running a Kickstarter, I'll have bookmarks or something to give out that has some information about the Kickstarter on. And I do like to distribute things that way. I just love the immediacy of that. I also use social media to talk about Trekker and get the word out that way. And that's much more a broadcast way to go. But that one-on-one conversation is, I think, the most powerful way to go about it.
Well, they always say that one-on-one conversations and one-on-one referrals are often the strongest ones to do. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what I say about it is the convention going is the most effective and least efficient way I can get the word out.
Well, I love that because I've got to tell you my experience, because as a Star Trek fan, every time I would see Trekker, I would kind of think it had something to do with Star Trek, but I wasn't exactly sure. And then finally I came across one of the books someplace, and I started to look through it, and I realized this is not Star Trek. This is something interesting, because they call Star Trek fans Trekkers and Trekkies and stuff. But you came up with this independently, right? The name came somewhere else, right?
Yeah, it's kind of for me, it was an unfortunate bit of timing is how I'd put it, because I first came up with Trekker, and this is going to date both me and the idea, but it was in 1985, 1986, when Dark Horse was first starting out. They approached me at a local convention and invited me to pitch something to them, to do something for them, basically. It was sort of like giving me a creative blank check. You can, if you work for us, you can do whatever you want, they said. So I started dreaming up my, you know, dream project. And when I came up with the basic concept, a young woman, a science fiction bounty hunter, because I felt that way I could throw just everything that I love the most about science fiction into a concept that had that sort of much elasticity to it. And when I was trying to come up with a name, I went through a few things. And when I came up with Trekker, that just sounded like a cool title that seemed to have some drama and a sense of action and motion to it. And I thought, oh, Trekkers, that could be the slang term for bounty hunters in this world. And I thought, well, there's Star Trek. But I thought, well, you know, at that time, Star Trek was more or less a dormant property. Mm-hmm. The original TV series had been off the air for 20 years. There'd been a movie, but, you know, movies and comics weren't that closely connected these days. And so Star Trek seemed like it was a pretty quiet property at the time. And I thought, here's a great title no one's using, so I'll use it. And as soon as I got the first story going at Dark Horse and we scheduled it or something, Paramount announced they were creating Next Generation. And I thought, well, that's pretty bad timing for me. But by then, my car's already rolling down the road, and I couldn't change it then. So we've learned to peacefully coexist, I guess.
I think so, because, you know, the people don't understand that Star Trek is not a complete word. There's a star and there's a trek involved with it. And the trek means the journey.
Yeah.
And if people don't realize
right,
that
exactly,
a lot of the
yeah.
time. So I'm always interested, because you have every right to the word Trek as much as Star Trek does, is my opinion. So I think that's great.
Yeah, it's right. It's just a word. And again, like you said, a Trek is a journey. And I that's another reason I like the title, because on the one hand, she's tracking down a bounty. So there's that sort of episodic, single adventure sort of aspect to the word and the concept. But there's also, she's on this longer journey, her life's journey, the journey of self-discovery and destiny or whatever, and an inward journey as well as an outward journey. So it appealed to me on a lot of levels, and it just became for me too compelling a title for me to turn my back on. So mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, there was that, I guess I would call it a coincidence or whatever. But and the other thing is, sometimes it has worked in my favor that somebody will come up and they'll say, oh, is this related to Star Trek? And I'll say, no, but it's another science fiction series. And, you know, for those people, you know, some people, if it's not Star Trek, they don't want to, you know, they just want the Star Trek stuff. Mm-hmm. But a lot of other people like Star Trek and they like other science fiction things as well. And I don't see any reason they couldn't enjoy my comic as well as, you know, the Star Trek franchise too. So again, peaceful coexistence. I'm quite big on that.
Yeah, I love the book. I think it's a great adventure book. We don't get much adventure.
Thank you.
There's often, you know, you do dialogue in a very cohesive, cogent way that doesn't interfere with the story going on. Because sometimes I turn a page and I see like 1,000 word balloons and I'm going, oh my gosh, am I going to have to read all that? But your stuff is much more, you know, you get to the point right quickly. There'll be some pages that have more dialogues than others, but I have to say that you get to the point of things really nicely and quickly, and then the adventure and the action picks up pretty quickly. So you do that timing so much better than I think a lot of other comics do.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, I've come to have a couple of pretty good sort of aha moments or revelation moments about my career and about what my craft really consists of. And one of them was a few years ago, I came to realize that my job as a cartoonist, it's not about drawing well, really, at core. It's not about being an illustrator. Those sort of drawing skills are important, but only in the service of what my real job is. And my real job is to be a storyteller. That's what I'm passionate about. I went to the Joe Kubert School, and man, that's something that Joe, it was just infectious from him. He was so passionate about when he had a script to draw. Whoever had written the script, whether it was something he had done himself, whether he was adapting, you know, Tarzan novels, or he was inheriting a script from, you know, somebody that had written something that had been turned in, Joe saw his job as to bring that story to life in a way that just pulled the reader in and wouldn't let you go. So he had, you know, real page-turner stuff. And that sensibility or that attitude just really took hold with me. So I'm all about trying to tell a story that compels the reader, and it's paced well so that, yeah, even though some scenes do have to have a certain amount of dialogue to set things up to give more context and framing, I'm always keeping in mind, is the forward momentum of the story still going along? And then the other thing, other than being a storyteller, is that a key feature of any really, really premier storyteller is selection of detail. Whether you're just telling a little a joke, you know, or a funny thing or a scary thing that happened as you're on the way to the grocery store, or you're trying to write a novel or a movie, the crucial thing is to put in all the details that a reader or a viewer needs to get the impact of your story, and not cluttered up with a lot of other stuff that you're putting in there that's superfluous to what the story is about. And that doesn't mean you can't have lots of interesting anecdotes that flesh things out and enrich the experience, but you don't want to just wander down dead ends and take a lot of detours. I find I lose patience with stories where that happens, where people spend too much time giving background information about other characters or the way this device works. I want enough to know that it's going to function in a certain way and it makes sense in the story and has a certain reality to it, but I don't need all the details if they're not really pertinent to what's going on. So
I'm interested because, you know, I talked to several creators who, exert that same sort of opinion, is that it's not necessarily to understand how everything is working and what happens. There's a book where there's like anthropomorphic animals walking around in the city. And, you know, The guy who writes it, you know, when he gets asked, well, why is there a walking tiger in the city? And he just says, well, there just is.
Yeah, right.
There's no point in explaining all this stuff. I mean, just sometimes you have to accept these things as they are. And I think that's good because sometimes I see this is where science fiction, I think, goes awry sometimes. You know, kids go up to actors and say, how does the warp drive work? You know, how are they possibly right. going to know that? You know, so you don't do with that. You focus on the story. And I think that's a really strong thing about Trekker.
Well, thanks a lot. I mean, I've always maintained that I don't have the most breathtaking, dazzling, mind-blowing, high-concept sort of stories going on. Those things don't interest me in the way that some people really do love to delve into all that sort of stuff. But I do think I have a pretty good sense for a strong, tough, sort of muscular storytelling that keeps rolling forward. And, you know, if you have a story where how the warp drive works is a key element to how the story is going to unfold, you know, then yeah, you probably do need to establish some of that stuff. Again, that's why I say by selection of detail. I don't think it's important for a reader to know necessarily how somebody's gun in Tracker's world might work, but they need to know that it does work and that it can, you know, kill somebody or is out of ammunition or whatever. So what about that gun or that warp drive is important to this particular story? Mm-hmm. Sometimes writers of science fiction or fantasy too, it happens a lot in fantasy, I think, creators can become so enamored of their own clever world building, which normally you try to do that as sort of backstory that you keep in the back of your mind that can inform the story you're telling, but you don't need to share all of that with the readers. But some people, they just get so excited. They're, oh, I was so clever about the way I had the dwarf civilization work out that I need to make sure that the readers know about all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So the story comes grinding to a halt where paragraphs go on and someone describes the dwarf civilization stuff. But all I really want to know is, our adventurer is going to get to the next task? Are they going to find a place to sleep this night? Are they going to find the gold they're after? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's some people, I think, they just, as readers, though, that love to go into like a fantasy world and just get lost in it. And so they probably really love that extra detail and stuff. But I try to keep that to a minimum and just, again, keep the momentum going ahead in my stories. That's more of a classic action-adventure sort of storytelling approach, I guess.
That's very good. I like to think that it's fast-paced and it's, it's action-oriented, which is the way I like to describe it. Now, before we get too far into this, there's a good reason why you and I are talking right now, because I'm going to get back to, you said so many things I want to come back and touch on, but let's get to the important part about your Kickstarter. You've got a Kickstarter going on right now. Talk about the Kickstarter that's happening right now.
Well, Kickstarter has been an absolute blessing for me and telling Trekker's stories. I originally did Trekker stories through Dark Horse Comics, and that was a great experience in most every way. The one thing that really became frustrating was trying to fit my books into the publishing schedule that Dark Horse needed to maintain for their whole line. It was just taking too long for me to get my stories to see the light of day. So finally, I turned to Kickstarter and said, well, let me just see if I can appeal directly to the readers that already like Trekker and can get enough support there to keep telling these stories in the sort of regular ongoing fashion and format that I think serves the series and the readers and myself the best. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled that the first Kickstarter I hit that launch button. I had no idea what was going to happen, but it funded quickly and went on to double its goal. The second Kickstarter funded even more quickly and also doubled its goal. So being able to work directly between me and the readers to determine the fate of this series, how quickly the books come out, to an extent the format they're going to be in, with enough support, I add extra content to the books and, you know, some enhancements, a little spot varnish on the cover, things that make the books feel really special. And I mean, I feel very proud when I hold one of these books in my hand. They just feel neat and they're substantial. Mm-hmm. So this third Kickstarter, the one that's running right now, is for a story called Trekker Battlefields. And that's where Mercy St. Clair takes a journey to the farthest reaches of the galaxy and the darkest, most volatile sector, the Delta Quadrant, and winds up sort of crash landing in ground zero of a full-blown war. And she's on a quest for answers into her past that that she wants to find out more about who she is and what her place should be in this complex future world she's living in. And that quest is going to put her right at the core of the conflicts between the large forces, the powers that are shaping her world. And that's where the story is taking a turn towards her reluctantly having to step into a role in that larger conflict. So the scale of things is rising. The stakes are rising. As I say, the stakes and the body count are rising in the story. Mm. It's, for me, it's thrilling because I started off with the series with a character she would track down a bad guy and track down another bad guy. But the idea was to plant seeds in those early stories. And then I was just a beginning writer when I started Trekker, and I knew I wanted to tell this large, expansive story, but I didn't have the writing chops to do that at the beginning. So I wanted to start out and sort of start slow and introduce a lot of elements with the thought of developing them later as the series went on. So I'm starting to get to the point now where all that stuff is starting to really come into play. So it's pretty exciting. I feel like I've got a good enough handle on my craft that I can hopefully pull this thing off. And I guess the other quick thing I'd say about the Kickstarter is that every Trekker book, for me, I really want each volume to work as a self-contained, you know, self-sufficient, standalone adventure where you're introduced to the character, the worlds. That particular adventure has its beginning, middle, and resolution all within one book and between those two covers. And then if you then go on to assemble the volumes together, you get this broader canvas story going on, her gradual life's arc, her evolution as a human being and as a character. I try to have work on both levels because the 12-year-old in me loves the spaceships and the explosions and the swamp monsters. And then the mature creator in me loves essentially a character study. I sometimes describe Trekker as a very long-form character study disguised as a series of action adventures.
Very cool. Now, of course, when does the Kickstarter end? Do you have a date on that?
Yeah, the Kickstarter comes to a hard end, as they say, on June 27th. And as your listeners, some of them probably are pretty familiar with Kickstarters, others maybe not. But when you launch a Kickstarter, you declare a funding goal. And if you hit that funding goal, all is well, you get that money. If you come a dollar short of that funding goal when your campaign hits its end date, you get zero. So it's kind of an all or nothing high drama, high stakes endeavor. So I'm waiting on pins and needles to see how this thing does and see if I get a good, strong response this time.
Well, based on your past experience, I'd say you will. I mean, I haven't committed yet, but I will definitely support it and looking forward to it because I supported the last one. That's the thing that I wanted to mention. Your previous one, I brought my book with me when I knew you were going to be at AwesomeCon so I could get you to sign it. I hadn't gotten it signed. And I was glad I brought all the little goodies that came with it, the picture of her and the little cards and stuff. Uh-huh. I loved all that stuff. I think it's just great stuff. But I'm very confident this is going to be another successful one for you because you've built a big, strong fandom, and I think that they're going to support you when you do these things. So I think that's cool.
Well, thanks very much. And yeah, I do. Thank you for mentioning that. That's another aspect that's really fun to do with Kickstarters. It feels like it's a much more personal, intimate, or direct, I guess I should say, relationship between me, the creator, and you, the backer, the fan, the supporter, the reader, whatever, however you want to, you know, characterize the people that are directly helping me bring these books to life. I really feel it's a very collaborative gesture. I've come to refer to the people I've met through Kickstarter and that back my books as the Trekker community. Mm-hmm. And I'm part of the Trekker community because I can't make the books happen without them, mm-hmm. without you. And one of the things you can do on a Kickstarter is And I do. I offer the book. If someone just wants to buy the book, they can get that at a very low pledge level. $15, you can have the graphic novel. But I also have these other levels where you can have fun extras added to campaigns, a little quick head sketch of the character on the inside front cover, some exclusive prints that you can only get through the Kickstarter that come signed. Other levels, you can buy previous volumes of the series. You can get original commission-style sketches of your favorite character, whoever it is, things like that. So it's a way to sort of that really personalizes the process for me and hopefully for the readers as well. When I was looking at the prospect of turning to Kickstarter, it was a little bit intimidating that I thought I'm going to have to spend so much of my time doing this other stuff. Anything that's not, you know, writing the stories and drawing the stories is not what I got into this industry to do. But in the 21st century and in the age of social media and crowdfunding and working on a project like Trekker, which doesn't really fit well with the grand schemes of the large publishing companies, this is the best avenue that I've found to take. And I have found how much I really love it. Mm-hmm. I love all those other aspects of the job much more than I ever thought I would. I thought, oh, I'm going to run Kickstarter. There's so much pressure and such stress and the burdens and all those other tasks and duties. Mm-hmm. And they are, it's a lot of work, but I love it. I love the people I meet. And the bottom line is I just really love telling these stories of these characters. And this is the way I can get those stories happening in the best way that I can imagine. So I feel lucky that I had the opportunity to do it.
Well, that's great. I think you do a good job of it, too, because, like I said, I was part of the last one, which was very successful. So those kinds of things, I think you're doing a great job with that. You've said so many things I want to go back and touch on. Let me go back. Sure. Back at the beginning of stuff. You started this like in the 1980s, you said.
Right.
Trekker was a female lead character in the 1980s.
Yeah.
That must have been very unusual at the time.
It was, and that's one of the reasons I did it. As I say, Dark Horse approached me. They were just starting out, small, you know, I mean, just the very beginning, little black and white comic book company at the same time as other little black and white indie companies are starting up, you know, First Comics and Kamiko and Eclipse. Those sort of companies were starting at the same time as Dark Horse was because the way comics were distributed was changing and direct sales comic book stores were coming on, so other smaller publishers could find ways to get their books out and hopefully find readers. And one way Dark Horse, I think, wanted to try to distinguish themselves a little bit from the pack of other small little black and white companies was to get some established pros to work for them. And so when they met me at the show, they said, like I said, they said, if you come and work for us, we'll pay you and you can do whatever you want, is essentially the message they gave me. And I said, I'll never hear that sentence again in my life. So I said, what would my dream project be? Yeah. And I've always loved science fiction, and there weren't many science fiction comics being done back then that had a sort of grounded sci-fi reality, as it were, to them, I felt. And that was one thing I wanted. And I did know from the beginning that I wanted a female lead character for a few reasons. There weren't many books like that around either. And I mean, I'd drawn comics where there would be women characters in it, but they tended to be things like, you know, sidekicks, love interests, eye candy, as they used to say. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, I'd like to know more about her story, you know. And so the thought about having a female character as, you know, a self-directing, drama-driving core of the series that I would just try to make as believable and real and immerse in this world of danger and drama and violence and put her through her paces and see how her personality emerges. And I just felt like a very compelling idea to me. And I guess I should also definitely need to give credit to Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn was a writer that I'd been working with a couple of years before I did Trekker. Mm-hmm. We did a series in the back of the Warlord comic book through DC. It was called The Barren Earth. And Gary had come up with an idea, a science fiction series, a different premise and a whole flavor to what Trekker had. But it was also a young woman was the lead in that story. And I had so much fun working on that with Gary that when I had a chance to come up with my own, I wanted something that sort of had some of those same basic elements. Because, again, it was rare to have an opportunity to do something like that in comics. And I've been gratified to find out that it's something that does resonate with people. People from the beginning of Trekker would come up and, you know, guys would come up and say, I got a girlfriend, she doesn't like many comics, but I can get her to read Trekker, and she really loves Mercy St. Clair. So I felt really gratified to get that kind of feedback. And I still, to this day, get that kind of feedback. And now, sometimes it's women readers that come up and say, I can't find many characters I can really get behind, but I really like what you're doing with Mercy St. Clair. So I feel very proud of that.
Very cool, very cool. I like the character a lot. I enjoy her, and I enjoy her thing. I always tell the story in this podcast, so if people have listened for a while, they'll hear this again. I have friends of mine who are women who want every lead character that's a female to be maternal. And I always tell them that's very limiting because, you know, male characters can be scoundrels and scientists and you name it. But what's great about you were way ahead of your time, in my opinion, because you came up with this action-oriented female lead that this could go on sci-fi right now and be considered, you know, current with the stuff they're doing. But you did this back in the 1980s, you came up with this. So I have to congratulate you on that. I said, wow, you were just ahead of your time.
Well, thanks a lot. They say timing is everything. And, you know, and when I created Trekker, I wasn't trying to, how can I put it? I wasn't trying to prove anything in that regard. I wasn't trying to say, oh, I'll show you how it should be done. I just thought it was a cool idea. And I said, if I like this idea, I can't be the only person. Mm-hmm. And if I had done it maybe a little before or a little after, or maybe done a few different things on it, maybe it would have caught fire a little bit bigger than it did. Maybe I just did it too soon. I don't know, but I'm not very canny and calculating about how to go about and try to make something, you know, commercial or whatever. I just wanted to do something that I, you know, so as the fire in the belly was there for me. I just wanted to do it. And so I'm gratified that years later, it's still finding more readers. And yeah, as I look at the landscape now and I see, yeah, there's a lot of characters out there. Like, I mean, I did Trekker before there was a Buffy or a Xena or a Tomb Raider or any of those things. So I guess I was kind of an unwitting pioneer or something.
Well, good. You know, it's better to be ahead of the curve than behind it, is all I have to say. So I think you're doing really good just as far as that goes. Now, I have to ask, is Mercy based on anyone you know, or is she purely a figment of your imagination?
Neither. That is to say, there's aspects of all that stuff. I've known some pretty remarkable women in my life, and there were a few places in pop culture that I could scoop little aspects that, you know, female characters that were, again, sort of self-directed and self-defining and that sort of stuff. But a lot of it just comes from, I think, anytime any writer creates any character, the writers generally will tell you there are aspects of me in that character. So largely when I was putting Trekker in situations, I was asking the question of, what would a reasonable response to this be? What would not a reasonable, because sometimes people are very unreasonable, but what would a realistic response? What feels like a human response that anybody would have in this sort of situation? And I figure probably 90% of the time, if I can give an authentic answer to that question, it will have the ring of, you know, it would have a ring of believability, whether the character is a woman or a man or whatever. So I just really tried to approach it that way, where her gender didn't vastly determine the way she was going to go about this job, a very pragmatic job of, you know, A, staying alive, and B, clawing out a living in a violent, complex world. So I try to have that be my primary focus. And then other aspects, the dynamics of things that come along in interpersonal relationships and stuff, I'm trying to craft that to have shadings based on her personality as she became a clearer character that was more alive in my own mind. Writers will often say, you know, the characters start to tell me what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that kind of happens as well. And I find those moments are real blessings. You know, they can sometimes surprise me. And I say, well, if the character feels that alive to me, again, I just sort of have the faith that that's going to come across on the page and communicated to other readers that, yep, she's being Mercy again, you know. she may be being difficult or prickly or argumentative or unreasonable, but that's, you know, sometimes that's who she is. And you just have to take her hopefully as a completely well-rounded human being. That's, I guess, the bottom line, that's what I'm trying to create here.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, I'm going to make a supposition here, and you tell me whether I'm way off base or not. I think if Mercy had been a guy, this series wouldn't have the longevity that it has.
I think that's true for me, at least. I mean, I'm not sure about readers. Maybe if I'd made it, maybe I'd come up with a bounty hunter guy back then, it might have been embraced more widely by the people who are probably more primed to expect that sort of comic book. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, but for me, like I said, there was something very compelling, and the female aspects of it, there were things about that that just, again, seemed to have a greater level of interest to me. And I've really been enjoying taking her on this emotional journey of personal evolution and self-discovery that I think anybody can have. if we're lucky, we all get to evolve somewhat as our lives go on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that maybe you're right. I certainly know it's certainly held my interest very completely for all this time.
Mm-hmm. I just enjoy the character. I enjoy the stuff she gets in. She's unpredictable in some senses, which is really enjoyable. I think guys tend to be much more predictable, so I think that having her as the lead character adds a little sense of urgency and a little sense of unpredictability that we would not have if this had been a guy, whatever guy you want to put in there.
I think, you know, that's a good point. I mean, you have a male action, you know, action-oriented character, there are certain sort of patterns to those stories that, you know, we can sort of project it. We've seen something kind of like this in the past, so it's probably going to play out in this way or that way. And you're right, the fact that she's got some different approaches to things, and there are just different elements at play. So even when the initial setup for the story might be something that we could see in a, you know, in a male sci-fi bounty hunter series as well, you're right. I think that there's a really good chance that the trajectory of this particular story is going to go different than the pattern that we might be expecting. I sure hope that's true, because that does sound and feel a lot more compelling to me. It's been very important for me that every one of these stories, I can sort of take a slightly different subgenre approach to within science fiction. You know, some science fiction stories and some Trevor stories they're sort of very much like the Blade Runner-y film noir sort of crime caper sort of story. Mm-hmm. Others, it's a sci-fi western. She's out in the blasted wastelands tracking down some desperado on foot, and it's almost as much mercy against, against a harsh, cruel nature as it is a shootout with a bad guy. Other times she's jumping on spaceships and flying through the stars, and again, you know, crash landing on swamp planets and stuff. So I found a series that, at least for me, can be a great container for all those different sort of stories from one to the next. And what keeps it from, I hope anyway, what keeps it from feeling disjointed is her vivid, compelling character and the arc her life is on. That's what holds all these stories together, so that she's in a wasteland one story, out in the stars the next story, but it's still another Mercy St. Clair Trekker adventure. I hope that the series always feels that magical balance you can have with a great series, where it's each story is kind of familiar but also fresh and somewhat different at the same time. Again, that's what keeps me interested anyway.
Well, two more things I want to talk about particularly. I want to talk about the girlfriend, because I like the fact that even when she's thrown into Mercy's world, shall we say, universe, she's still able to survive and do things on her own, even though she's a very different person. I love the way you portray that. These two work well together because they're not exactly the same. I like that.
Yeah, they're really absolutely not. Mercy's girlfriend is Molly Sundowner, and they've been very close friends from the very beginning of the series. But I played the long game with that relationship, because from the beginning, the idea is Mercy is incredibly good at her job. She shoots people, she gets paid for it, and it's a very comfortable arrangement for her. Her job may not be easy, but it's straightforward. And the idea about emotions and relationships, and at the same time, the bigger forces that are, you know, pulling the strings and trying to shape the course of humanity, all that stuff, that's not on her radar, because, you know, it's enough for her to just do this thing and survive. So she's got her walls up. But she always makes time for Molly. they get together. They have a lunch together. They're shopping together. Molly's often teasing Mercy about the relationships that Mercy's in. But Mercy's never able to make a go with any of those relationships. Mm-hmm. And after a long, slow burn, some big, fairly dramatic revelations happen to Mercy, and in a couple of the most recent stories. And Mercy has this sudden awareness that she's actually in love with Molly. And all along, Molly's been in love with Mercy, but knew that Mercy wasn't there yet. Anyway, and it's been tremendously gratifying to see that relationship has really been embraced by readers. Mm-hmm. To me, it just added a tremendous amount of depth and emotional landscape to continue to explore with the characters. And at the same time, it's also really important to me that Molly is definitely not an action science fiction bounty hunter character. Mm-hmm. Molly is a musician, and she is incredibly self-possessed. She is incredibly, she has a lot of sort of self-awareness and self-knowledge in a lot of areas that Mercy is pretty clueless about. Molly's definitely the one who's the guide in those regards. So they have vastly, vastly different personalities and strengths, but they have an incredible connection with each other and respect for each other's abilities and high regard for each other. And it's a relationship that to me brings a great sense of sort of completeness to both of the characters. And I've discovered that I've been, I guess, a closeted romance writer all these years without knowing it, because I really enjoy getting to portray these two women and the dynamic between them. You know, Molly's just full of charm and sort of grace, and Mercy's kind of awkward and blunt, unless she's out doing, you know, her real job. But she's safe in Molly's hands. She's off balance because this is a whole new world for her to explore. But she's happy to be experiencing it with Molly. So it's been a great new sort of facet to add to these tales.
I have to say that Molly to me is a little more on the mysterious side. I mean, Mercy is pretty straightforward, but there are aspects of Molly that I don't think we understand quite yet, because there's the revelation as we go along of her, and like she's in this one situation that would have been perfect for Mercy, but she has to figure out a way to take care of this alien guy that is paying attention to her, and she does it in her way. I love the way she did it her way, not Mercy's way, that she had this way. We get to learn a little bit more about the character when she does that stuff.
Yeah, she's got some depths and, what can you say, aspects to her that we haven't been able to explore yet. And as the two continue to build and deepen their relationship, more of that stuff will come out. And, and as you say, thank you. I'm glad it comes across that way, that Molly can come up with her own solutions, and they're just not the ones that Mercy would do at all. It has to do with, again, a sort of a self-possession that Molly has. She's clear in who she is. And, you know, some people just have that, whatever you want to call it. They're very centered in themselves. And it can be an incredibly compelling character to have. It's hard to tell a lot of stories with a lot of great drama and tension with that character by themselves. But Mercy tends to bring plenty of the tension and drama. So Molly often works as a great counter. She's Molly's like the still center, and Mercy's like, you know, blasting around all over the edges. So again, like a lot of couples, it's that opposites attract sort of thing, I guess.
Exactly. I was just going to say that's the way that it works. One other thing I want to talk about, and you mentioned it, and I've got to get back to it, is world building. I have this thing, current comics, one trend that drives me absolutely insane is taking people and sticking them in an existing costume in an existing world. And basically, I mean, just what challenges are there for that? But when you have to create your own universe like you have, you've generated an entire universe by yourself and made these characters and everything flow and work well together. And I always have to applaud that when I see that, because, you know, it's easy to write a Spider-Man story or a Batman story because we know everything about them. You know, and you're probably going to have to reset things when you get to the end of it. But with yours, your characters grow and move as well as the situation. And I just love that about the storage. I love the world building. I wish more people could do that, because we need more of that.
Well, thanks. I it's one of the things that appealed to me about this series from the beginning. I liked the idea about both the responsibility and the freedom that can come when I do get to build this entire universe, as it were, from the ground up. I didn't have to play within the rules that were established by, you know, 25 years of continuity with a past character, or set in a world where I've got to know how spark plugs work or something like that. The daunting part of it was, how do I make everything sort of feel cohesive, like it all fits in the same universe, that, again, as the stories go on, the scale of things expand and things we get to introduce to different, you know, civilizations and other planets and that sort of stuff, and different sort of types of technology in a way. But I guess it's all sort of grounded or built out of certain things that I fell in love with as a pretty young sci-fi fan and reader, that gave me a pretty good feel for what rules I wanted to work within, what range of things I wanted to go with. I mean, there's a certain amount of swashbuckly, Flash Gordon-y quality to some of the things I love. And there's also a lot of really the groundedness of, like, a Hal Foster's Prince Valiant, where he did such research into the way that, you know, Vikings made their saddles that, as Joe Kure once said to me, I think, when Hal Foster would draw the saddle on a horse, you could tell how thick the leather would have been. And Joe himself, you know, when he would be drawing a Sergeant Rock comic book, you know, you knew that he knew how that bolt worked on an M1 rifle. And he knew how things clipped onto the belts and that sort of stuff. So that sense of trying to make the world feel tactile and real and well thought through serves me really well when I'm doing an entirely imaginary world. Because even if the cars are flying around in the air, but the door handles and latches seem to work and the way people buckle on their their shoulder harnesses and stuff, if that sort of stuff seems recognizably real, then I think a reader is willing to extrapolate. And I try to have that a consistent degree of sort of believability, even when you're crash landing on a swamp planet. It's a combination of wanting to research things in the real world and then extrapolate a little bit beyond those so that it does feel somewhat extraordinary and exotic and compelling and imaginative, but still without ever seeming like it's gone so far out there that it doesn't connect with the real experiences that we've all had, you know, just walking around and living our lives. But I'm glad it works for you. It certainly is a great fun challenge for me every time out.
Well, I think it's great. And I don't know how much, if I had to take a clock apart and put it back together, if I could do it. I just know it works. So I'm happy right. with that. So it's kind of that setup. So it's the next one's going to be called Battlefields. I wanted to mention, too, you and I talked a little bit about the fact that there aren't numbers on these books, and it's, getting to know which one comes in what order it was something for me. But if you go to trekkercomic.com and go to archives, you'll go and you'll see you've got them listed in numerical order up to, and you've even got pages of Battlefields up there now. It comes out once a week, looks like. You put it.
Yeah, I post a new page on the website. Every Monday I post a new page there, which that's how I could get back to doing Trekker. The whole series had been on hiatus for about 12 years a while ago, and I finally returned to it when I realized I could build a website, start posting stories that way, and then that got the ball rolling for me to get back into it. I always knew I wanted to get back to Trekker. All those 12 years, fans at conventions would say, when are you going to get back to Trekker? When are you going to? And I said, well, I've got the next script is written. It's waiting for me to get around to drawing it. Once I built the website and started posting pages, that's how that got going. Hmm. So, yeah, I do post a new page every week. But one of the nice things about this Kickstarter, the previous campaigns, it had taken so long for Dark Horse to be getting the books out that those stories were done and had been posted online, completely finished, before I ran the Kickstarters. Hmm. But the Battlefield story is a nice long story, and if the Kickstarter is successful, this book will get printed and into readers' hands before it finishes posting online, which has always been my goal. Mm. The idea about the Trekker Comic website is my intention is that to be essentially like an archive that people can go to dip into past stories or to stumble upon the character, get a little sampling of what she's like there, and then seek out the printed volumes, because that's the format that I've always intended them to be experienced in. And I think it's the most effective way to read the comic books. I think you get more out of them that way. That's my take anyway. Plus, I don't make any money when people go and read the stories for free online.
Right.
And this is theoretically my career, not just a hobby for me.
Right.
Oh, and the other thing I will say about the reading order. Yes, you're right. The books do not have numbers on the covers. And I kind of went back and forth with Dark Horse about that originally. So my solution for that, to replace that lack, because I don't necessarily want to emphasize, oh, this is, you know, volume, whatever it is, I guess I better go and read 1-4 first. It's important to me that every story works as a standalone story. Mm-hmm. But if you want that deeper context and get the sequence on one of the inside first pages, I have a list of all the stories. And that list is in the order that they can be read. And if you want to read everything sequentially like that. So I'm trying to hit that balance between wanting the books to work as a standalone set of volumes, but also paint that in that larger canvas we were talking about. That's the solution I came up with.
Well, like I said, I got in trouble when I tried to figure out which one of the three I should read first. And so,
right.
But I figured it out. I went with the Dark Horse one first, and then I read the others after that. So I got into that. Now, do you know how many pages you're going to have in Battlefield?
The lead story is 74 pages. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do, because I don't start drawing a story until I've gotten the script written, mm-hmm. you know, written and rewritten, and it's ready to go. It's a 74-page story is the lead feature. And then each of these Kickstarter volumes has a main lead feature, Battlefields in this case. Mm-hmm. And then I always have a second story that is sort of like a supplemental story. Mm-hmm. It's other things that I think give extra richness and context and sometimes the aftermath or whatever, the extension of the main story. And that one's going to be 14 pages. And then I'll have another little 6-pager, I think, of one of the Kickstarter reward levels, the highest level is I will draw you in a story, special extra story. And then you will get the original art for the page that you appear on. That's been a very popular reward level at the first two campaigns. And it's turned out to be a tremendous amount of fun for me to craft a special little story that's a little bit lighthearted, usually not exactly whimsical. And it still fits in within the context and the continuity of the series. I always want to make sure that no story is just a cast off or a novelty thing. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the tapestry. Mm-hmm. So there'll be three different stories altogether, and that comes up to, what did we get there, about 90-some to 100 pages.
Mm-hmm. That'll be good. It'll be fun to read. I can't wait to get it. Like I said, I'm going to be signing up real quickly and getting supporting it, because I think the last one was such a great experience for me. And then I got to meet you, and I got to buy the other books. Just to let you know, I have bought and downloaded the Omnibus and another collection, which I didn't get a chance to read before we got to talk, but I am going to sit down and read those, because I'm so looking forward to reading some of the backstory.
Well, great.
To this.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you picked those up. And those earlier stories, all the books that came out through Dark Horse are currently out of print. So I have a few copies of the last one that came out through Dark Horse, the Rites of Passage book, the one that you mentioned that you read first, that I will be able to offer at one level on this Kickstarter. But the plan is, after this Kickstarter, again, if this is a successful campaign and I get to keep doing this, the next one I'm going to run early next year, I'm planning on doing one that will collect all those earlier stories and bring them back into print to have probably in a hardcover sort of, bookshelf sort of, Ultimate Collection Volume 1 or something like that.
Like so, Ultimate Trekker?
So that's the plan.
Ultimate Trekker?
Yeah, I think I'd call it The Complete Journey Volume 1 is probably what I will, okay, would be the subtitle for it. But it's because it's great that the stories, you can, as you did, get the digital downloads to get the backstory, the earlier issues. And I'm proud of a lot of those stories, even though I did them quite a while ago now, and I look at them and I can also see, it's a little clunky passage there or whatever, like any artist can do. But all those stories are important to set the groundwork and get the ball rolling on what Mercy and Molly's journey has become. And I do want to get them all back into print too. So,
cool.
But for now, digital. But if this campaign works, we'll be doing that next.
Oh, good. If you do that one, I'll be after that, because I would like to have this all in one volume. That would be fun to have.
Fantastic.
Now you said this is a passion project for you, but obviously
yes,
you have to do other things to make a living and stuff. Is there stuff that we should be aware of that you're doing as well?
Right now, I don't have anything that I'm working on that's going to be coming out on the bookshelves from the companies. I just did a couple of things last year. I did a book at DC called The Sasquatch Detective, which is about as far from Trekker's world as you can get. It was very much in a cartoony style, a character that grew out of the Hanna-Barbera. Was it Hanna-Barbera? It was like the Snaggletooth and those sort of books that DC put out last year. So that was a fun change of pace for me. But right now, the other projects that I'm working on are sort of private commissions and a project to do a graphic novel for someone that's going to be looking for a publisher for that. And those sort of things that I can't talk about yet because they're still, early enough in development. But I'll do everything I can to keep myself good and visible. But the primary thing I want people to think about me is going to be the Trekker books.
Now, of course, I saw you at AwesomeCon. What other conventions are you going to be at this year?
I'm going to be at HeroesCon, which comes up in, the second week in June, I believe. And that's in Charlotte. And I've been lucky enough to have been there once a couple of years ago. It was an amazing show. I'm doing that one in June. Then a week or two after that, also in June, here in my hometown of Portland, there's a small first-year show called the Portland Indie Con. Portland has a great show in the fall called Rose City Comic Con. That's kind of like shaped after the shows that have, some media celebrities and a lot of stuff going on. But Portland has an awful lot of indie comics and creator-generated projects in this town and a vibrant, vital comics community. So this show, I think, is going to be geared more towards that. And Trekker sort of straddles both of those worlds. It's come out through Dark Horse. It has certain aspects of it that sort of feel kind of like a mainstream comic, action, adventure, and all that stuff. But it's about as indie a comic can be right now since I'm self-publishing it. So I'm happy to be at shows like that as well. And then I have a few more in the fall. I'll be doing the Rose City show that I mentioned. There's a show in August in Boise, Idaho. I'm going to do a show out there. So
cool.
I try to get around and do a fair amount of conventions because it's a great way to meet fans. And I just really love the conversations I have with fans at those shows. But every time I'm doing a show, that's a handful of days that I'm not in the studio crafting the next story. And so trying to get that balance right is always a challenge.
Do you go to Emerald City? Because that's out in your neck of the woods.
I do that every year. Okay. Yeah. It's a terrific show. It started off as a well-run small show, and I think it has grown very smartly every single year. It's gotten bigger, and it's now a very large major show, but it has never gone through what I call that sort of awkward adolescence that some conventions go through, where they first expand and they add an extra day, or they add a much larger, extra other section of the convention center they happen to be in. And a lot of times fans are wandering around confused about where they're supposed to be going or frustrated that they didn't know how to get in. And I've never gotten the sense that Emerald City has ever had that those rough patches. I mean, every show has little glitches here and there, but Emerald City, it seems like it's been able to have about as smooth a transition from being a well-run but kind of, you know, smallish scale show to a very major show with they did it with a lot of, I'd say, a lot of grace and class. So I love Emerald City.
Well, we didn't get there this year, but we were there last year, and I have to say I was totally impressed. Six floors of a convention, and all perfectly organized. I mean, you know where everything is. That's just great.
It's so well laid out. Yeah, and that was, I think, a couple of years ago. I think that was the first year where they made what, to that point, had always felt like it would be a radical step when any convention does that. And that's where they take the main convention hall, where it has like the dealers and the comic companies, if they're there, they'll have their booths and displays and stuff. And also the artist alley, where the creators tend to be, all in one large floor. And a couple of years ago at Emerald City, they took all of those artists and moved us from that main dealer fourth floor up to the sixth floor. Mm-hmm. So all the sixth floor was the artist alley, all the creators. So the way I describe it is, and that was a very busy show then. Mm-hmm. So it's like there was a convention on the top floor. That's the Comics Fest thing, where people go, where creators and fans can interact and celebrate the creation of the comic books and meet the people that actually make it happen. Mm-hmm. And then you have the dealer's floor, where there's the merchandise going on and you can buy your bobbleheads and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then another area of the convention, which seems to be centered on the whole gaming community and that stuff. And then, and then elsewhere are where the celebrity panels and appearances and those sort of things happen. So it's sort of like a four-ring circus is the way I've described Emerald City. And I'm sure it's not the only convention that's sort of structured and set up that way, but it's the one that I've experienced where since I've been there every year and I've seen this incremental growth and see it sort of evolve into this over the years. I just been very impressed with it.
It's my favorite one. Well, I like San Diego a lot. I enjoy it, but it's not as well run, I should say, as Emerald City is, in my opinion. So the Emerald City that we were at, I mean, I just loved it. The only thing I didn't like was having to run up six flights of stairs to get to the Artist Alley. that took a lot out of me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they got escalators and elevators too, but you know, there's often, you know, you have to slog through a long crowd to get to those things. Even under the best of conditions, you can only do so much with crowd control when you've got that many people that want to get to your event. I'm glad I don't have to try to run one of these things. I have no idea how anybody can pull one of these things off. That's like a magic act to me. I'm very impressed.
It's just great. It's one of my favorite shows that I've been to. I really loved it. And I'm glad I got to talk to you at AwesomeCon, so I get to talk to you now. And I'm wishing you much success. I'm certain this is going to be another success for you at Kickstarter. So Battlefields, what's Trekker? Battlefields, I guess, is the best way to say it. And I'm going to be contributing too very shortly, so we're going to make this a success, and then we get on to the event. I want that collected edition. I'm all excited about that now. I want to have one of those. So you're doing wonderful stuff, Ron. Boy, keep it up. I want to see more Trekker for a long time to come because it's great stuff. Good reading. Good stuff.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I want to see Trekker coming for a long time to come. That's exactly right, Wayne. I appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.